Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. My guest today is Nils Norén, who is the founder of Absolute Culinary, which is a culinary consulting firm, and a former executive chef at Covid in New York City, as well as a former vice president of restaurant operations for the Marcus Samuelson Group, and he also served as vice president of culinary and pastry arts at the International Culinary Center. So it's quite impressive and extensive experience in culinary fields. And Nils has been always interested in Japanese cuisine, and his culinary style has a lot of Japanese influence. So today, we'll discuss how Nils got into Japanese cuisine, similarities between Japanese and Swiss cuisines, and he applies Japanese elements to his dishes, and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes and Stitcher as podcasts. So please go to iTunes and Stitcher and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review on iTunes and Stitcher, and we really appreciate your feedback. And also, if you have any ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. And you can email us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or akikokatayama.com. Now let's start a conversation with Nils Norén. Hello, Nils. Welcome to Japan Eats.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, Akiko.
So you are originally from Sweden, Stockholm, Sweden. And what kind of food did you eat when you grew up?
I would eat very traditional Swedish food because that's mostly what was around back then. There wasn't much ethnic food in Sweden, except there was quite a few Chinese restaurants, but you know, after working in China, I realized that they didn't really serve Chinese food, but otherwise that is pretty much Swedish food.
Right. Okay. So what do you mean by Swedish food?
Swedish food is, what can I say, it's very rustic in a sense. You know, we do a lot of curing, pickling. You know, Sweden is cold a lot of the times. So a lot of the food is based on preserving. So that's where the curing, pickling, and everything come in. It's a lot of stews and everything as well.
Interesting. Because Japan is also like that. It's been, especially, you know, Japan is a very cold area, hot area. And the country was closed for 200 years. They had to preserve a lot of stuff. So there's so much in common.
There is actually quite a lot of similarity in Japanese food and Swedish food. I think also in the flavor profiles, because you use a lot of fish. You use, as I said, pickling, vinegar, sugar to a certain extent, right? It becomes sweet and sour a lot, and also in the simplicity of the food as well.
And also, both countries have a lot of fish.
Yes.
That's major resources.
And it actually also extends further to design as well. There's a lot of similarities in Japanese design and Scandinavian design.
Mm. So less is more kind of simplicity.
Yes.
Right. That's interesting. Right. So so how did you get into the world of food?
So, yeah, that's a good question. You know, growing up, I saw myself as being a musician. That's what I was going to be.
Oh, wow. you look like still.
Yeah, I had actually a couple of reggae bands back in Sweden.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were performing and all of that. But at one point, I realized I'm not going to make any money off this. and the next day, I woke up and I was like, I want to be a cook. I want to cook.
Hmm.
And two weeks later, I was enrolled in culinary school.
Wow. So
never looked back.
Suddenly.
Yeah. I mean, I enjoyed cooking before, but I never thought of it as it would be a career.
Hmm.
But never. Except that one day I woke up and it's like, I want to cook.
Oh,
and
wow.
2 weeks later, I was in culinary school and I never looked back since.
That's called calling.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So did you train by going to culinary school or how did you?
Yeah, so I went to culinary school, very much focused on cooking. It was a short program. Mm. So because, you know, I already went through high school and all of that, so it was not academic in that sense. It was based on cooking. And it was also quite a long period of internship as well.
Mm.
But the program itself was, I think, only 8 months or something.
Right. It's very intense. And then you graduated in Sweden.
Yes, correct. So actually I started working at one of the places where I interned, and which was one of the first restaurants in Sweden that got a star in Guide Michelin. So it was amazing.
Wow.
Restaurant to start working in.
Mm. But you actually joined, that was out of luck, or you just already talented?
So. It wasn't out of luck, because I did seek out that restaurant, and actually I knew someone that worked there.
Mm.
Not that well, but still,
right.
I did. So I reached out, and I got in.
Right. So it sounds like it's a Swedish restaurant.
It's French food.
Okay.
Because back then, a lot of the so-called fine dining was still all about the French food. But I did, after, you know, a few other jobs, I became chef for another Michelin star restaurant, but actually the first one that got a star in Guide Michelin for cooking Swedish food.
Okay, right. So then what brought you to New York City?
The restaurant which I talked about last, the owners of that restaurant, they were actually part of opening Aquavit in New York back when it opened in 1984.
Right.
So, you know, the restaurant did really well. We kept, you know, year after year, we kept the star in Guide Michelin, and they were like, you know, we want to send you somewhere. And I would ask, I'd never been to New York. I would love to go to New York.
Mm.
So they set it up so I could go to New York and spend some time at Aquavit. And I happened to meet Marcus Samuelson there.
Right.
He was a cook at that time. And we worked together for a week or so.
Mm.
And then, you know, we became friends. And, you know, I left and said goodbye and blah, blah, blah. And a few months after that, I get a call from Marcus.
Mm.
And he says, you know, I'm the chef at Aquavit now. I would like you to come over and work with me. And he thought I was going to say no, polite Swedish no, but I happened to say yes. And then, and I was 95, and I think I got to New York in June. And then, actually, it wasn't as busy of a restaurant back then, but we changed the whole menu and everything. And in September, we got a 3-star review in New York Times from Ruth Reichold, and that's kind of, the restaurant took off, doubled in volume and all of that. It was a lot of fun. It was crazy as well.
Right. I mean, that time there was no Noma, and Scandinavian cuisine was, what is it?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Herring. Yeah.
So that was really the pioneer restaurant, right? Okay. And you became eventually executive chef in 2003.
Correct.
So That is amazing. But what was your first encounter with Japanese food?
So my first encounter was actually with my very first job in Stockholm. Someone that actually became a very close friend of mine, he happened to be one of the chefs that opened one of the first sushi restaurants in Sweden.
Wow.
Even though he was Swedish, but he had, learned somewhat about sushi and such. So he got me into it. And he, you know, we would go to his house on the weekends and he would teach me how to make sushi as well as we could. So wow. It's actually pretty good. Mm. So that's how I got into it. And then there were a few Japanese restaurants in Stockholm that I like to go to. And then, but really when I came to New York, that's when I, you know, you had so much more variety of Japanese food.
But I'm just curious that the first time you made sushi, what was it? Did you find something unique about Japanese food?
It was just so amazing. You know, I think, you know, the flavor, the texture, everything. It was amazing. It was so eye-opening.
Mm. Okay. So it sounds like you talked about similarities between Swedish and Japanese cuisine. So that's the simplicity, and it really focused on the flavor.
Yes, exactly. And also, what I really appreciate in Japanese culture and cooking is the appreciation of the ingredient as well.
Right. Yeah, I'm curious, Japanese restaurants tend to be more divided or temporized, a tempura place, 100% tempura.
Yeah.
And sushi is sushi.
Yeah.
So do you have any favorite genre out of those?
To be honest, I don't, because it's, you know, one day you'll be, you know, I really want amazing sushi and sashimi, or the next time it's cold day, you know, you want, you know, great noodles. So I haven't come across any Japanese food I don't like, I don't appreciate.
Okay. Yeah, that's a question, because I'm curious as a chef, you know, there's certain techniques or some crazy mindset doing this over and over, so years and years. So, yeah, that's why I asked that question. But I agree totally. You want to hop around and then appreciate everything differently. Right. So Sakubi was and still is one of the most recognized and great Scandinavian restaurants, I think, in the States and in the world, actually. So so shortly after you joined Marcus in 1998, you became executives in 2003, and... So what kind of dishes did you cook at the Kuwait? Did you have any Japanese-influenced dishes?
We had a lot of Japanese influence, actually. And not only in the food we cooked, also in the plateware and stuff. I think we were probably one of the first, certainly not the first, but one of the first that really started to buy a lot from Corin.
That's a knife company.
Yes, exactly. And they also have a lot of tableware and stuff, so... On my days off, I would go down to Tribeca and pick up, servingware and plates and stuff and bring back. Mm. And then we used tons of Japanese ingredients, whether it was, you know, kombu, you know, mirin, obviously miso, and a lot of other things. And we had a lot of dishes that, you know, I remember one dish, for example, it was we called it, back then when... We call it the Kobe beef roll or something like that. But anyway, it was thinly sliced Kobe beef. We filled it with a taro root puree.
Mm.
And then we made like a dashi broth with it. And then we had a salad of honshimeidi mushrooms and something on top. But it was like the approach and the flavors in that broth was very much influenced by Japan.
Mm. So it's not the sauce-based. It's more like how you enhance the ingredients, flavors. Wow, that must be really good.
it was a very good dish.
Okay. So you used a lot of Japanese ingredients.
Yeah, a lot, actually.
Mm. What was your favorite?
Obviously, miso. Even miso is very broad, but there's some amazing misos out there. And I always really liked also the Japanese fish sauce as well.
It's ishiri.
Which is made from squid, mostly, I believe.
Right.
Yeah. And it has such a has amazing depth of flavor. And what's kind of also interesting is, from what I can tell, it's done very much the same way as the Romans did their fish sauce, garum. Like the Romans, way back, they fish sauce was one of the staple ingredients in a lot of their cooking. Right. And that fish sauce was made very much the same way.
Interesting. Yeah, Ishiri, if you go to Kanazawa and Ishikawa Prefecture, and then just everybody's talking about Ishiri, and basically it's made with squid intestines.
Yeah.
And it sounds gross, but it's really full of umami because it has a lot of amino acid called taurine.
Yeah.
And I heard also it's like full of antioxidants. So it's healthy and lots of umami. And if you don't think of just the intestine, it's...
It's delicious.
Right.
And, yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, we use sausages and the same idea. But it's really... Yeah, yeah, I think it's such a proud product in Kanazawa, Ishikawa Prefecture. Right. Okay. And I heard it's fermented for... Well, it's first, I think it's salt pickled and then fermented naturally for 2 to 3 years. So it's the whole amino acid broken down.
Yeah.
Right.
No, it's a great product.
Mm. Okay. And so do you have any Japanese techniques that you used?
Yeah, absolutely. One technique that's actually probably my favorite Japanese technique is ikijime, which is, you know, the way to how you kill and bleed a fish.
Right.
And when I was at the ICC, International Culinary Institute, we did a lot of experiments, me and Dave Arnold, on ikijime.
Right.
And it's actually amazing when you do blind tests and blind tastings to see the difference.
Mm. Or maybe some of our listeners may not be familiar with ikijime. Maybe you can just brief it.
Yes. So ikijime is the way where you bleed the fish and also you put up a... usually metal stick through the spine of the fish to kill any energy that's left behind. So what it does is that obviously you get rid of the blood, which makes it cleaner tasting. And also when you put that metal rod up the spine, the fish goes slower into rigor mortis than it would otherwise. So you get a better texture and flavor from that. And one thing that people don't talk about enough either, which the Japanese do, but not elsewhere so much, is it's really important to age fish the right way. And certain fish age different ways. Like you can have, you know, you can have, for example, people do it with fluke, right? I had in Japanese restaurants where you get the fresh fluke, they kill it right there and serve it before it goes into rigor mortis. And then side by side, they serve a five-day-old fluke.
Right.
And I think actually the five-day-old always tastes better.
Mm-hmm. Right. So by breaking down all those nervous system, I heard that fish doesn't recognize that, oh, I'm dead. So they don't get tightened.
No, exactly. They do get tight, but they go slower into it.
Mm-hmm.
Like everything will go through rigor mortis, but they go slower into it.
Mm. Right. So for aging, it's a cleaner taste, and then it's kind of like texture-wise, it's more like softer, natural. Right. Okay, I heard some fishermen in this country started to learn how to do ikijime because it sells more expensive.
Yeah, obviously it is more expensive to do, but it makes a big difference.
Right, okay. And have you done it by yourself?
Oh, yeah, many times.
Right, at the aquarium?
Yeah, mostly at school, but even now if I go out fishing, doesn't happen that often, but when I do, I always use it.
Right. Wow, I've seen it many times, but it sounds very difficult.
It's actually not that difficult.
Oh,
like you gotta know exactly where to put the metal.
Okay,
but otherwise it's not that hard.
Okay, yeah, because they're still like, you know, splashing and very violently moving. So
no, it's not that.
No? Okay, yeah, maybe I should try one day.
Yeah, you should.
So I heard that you often develop a dish based on the shape. So I found it very interesting because Japanese cuisine has a lot to do with the shape. And for instance, sashimi is often plated vertically like a cone, and we call it the sugimori, meaning shaped as a cedar tree. Or you may notice that there's a flow from left to right in many traditional Japanese dishes, which is called nagashimori, which means flow plating. So what is your idea of shape? Because they say in Western plating tend to be based on symmetrical shapes versus Japanese asymmetrical shapes. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I've always been interested in design as well, and still am. So I think a lot in shapes.
Mm.
And also, like, flavors, not that flavors is easy, that's not what I'm trying to say, but I'm pretty good with flavors. So when I think about a dish, I keep thinking in shapes, but also in how each ingredient relate to each other,
mm.
right? Because the one thing that I have a hard time is when dishes are plated so it doesn't make sense. Like, you have to cut something from one side of the plate mm. and then move it over to the other side of the plate to get everything to work together.
Mm.
So I always think in shape and how they relate, each ingredient relate to each other and how you should eat it.
Mm-hmm.
Very much actually like the Japanese. For example, like, and I would do the same thing. I would actually plate it from left to
mm.
right
mm.
in the order and how it makes sense. So you get everything in every bite.
Right. So the functional, natural
yes.
flow of actually eating. Right. Okay. And do you think of that, you know, like, say, if you go to Japanese, like kaiseki cuisine, you know, they make a plate as if you're looking at the nature, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Do you think of that too?
I mean, maybe not as much of nature
mm-hmm.
as they do in Japan, but what I do really appreciate, and what I do think is, you know, understand that the dish you have
mm.
is for the season, if that makes sense. And what I also appreciate with Japan is, you know, you don't think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you don't think of seasons necessarily as four
mm.
seasons, right? They're much more.
Right.
In a sense, every month is a season, right? Because there are
right.
new things.
They say 24 or something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So, but that's really interesting that your application of Japanese idea, it really is natural. So it's just like you just got inspired and you just...
Yeah, but it's more that I found out later on that that's also how Japanese
mm.
cuisine is.
Right.
So I didn't even know that it was that connection
mm.
in the right. way I think about food.
Right.
A lot of times.
Mm. One thing when I do this radio show, I'm learning constantly. There's so many things I didn't know. And I really appreciate being in New York. And then it's an inspiration. Right? By looking at comparing different kinds of cuisine, you realize, wow, this has a meaning. And
yeah.
this is the benefit of global scene of the cuisine, especially like places like New York City or even everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, New York is amazing food city.
Right. Yeah. That's why you're here. You've been here
yeah.
for, ended up being
yeah.
here for years and years. Right. Okay, so we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll discuss the idea of Japanese cuisine cooked by Western chefs. So please stay with us.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledged the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
Hey, like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japanese, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Nils Norén, who is the founder of Absolute Culinary, which is a culinary consulting firm. And Nils is also a former executive chef of Akavit in New York City, as well as former vice president of restaurant operations for the Marcus Samuelson Group. And he also served as vice president of culinary and pastry arts at the International Culinary Center. So we've been talking about a lot of stuff, and you're now you're one of the pioneer chefs who introduced Japanese elements to Western cuisine. And you see more non-Japanese chefs using Japanese ingredients and cooking methods and plating in the dishes nowadays. So in your opinion, what is the relevance of Japanese cooking done by non-Japanese chefs?
I think it's very interesting, actually, with non-Japanese chefs cooking Japanese, because they aren't as bound by tradition as Japanese chefs would be. But I guess if you would ask a Japanese chef, or especially someone that's older, they would argue that it's not Japanese cooking at all, because they couldn't cook Japanese because they haven't grown up in that. But for me, I think it's actually very interesting food that comes out that way, when you're not bound by saying a dashi always have to be done this way, or certain things always have to be done that way. You know, I think it evolves the food. But I guess the question is, like, where does Japanese ends and start,
right,
in terms? And you know, maybe you as a Japanese can answer that question better than me. But I do think it's a really interesting food coming out.
Right. Well, actually, there is always elements of fear if you have tradition. Breaking tradition, I think any European countries, any places without like that freedom of not having the obligation to follow the tradition. So
yeah, but I do think that Japanese in many ways have a stronger, how should I say, bond to tradition than in many other countries, at least from what I can tell from my visits and to Japan and Japanese.
I
cooks
agree.
That I work with.
Right. I think back in the mind, say, well, chefs or any other craftsmen, I think they tend to feel if you break the rule, it's kind of disrespectful act to whoever built it to perfection. So
yeah,
it's kind of like feeling of awe and guilt.
Yeah.
So it's beautiful. But for instance, do you know Seiji Yamamoto of Ryugen? He's a chef. He was trained very traditionally in Kaisei cuisine, and he has three Michelin stars.
Yeah.
And I saw his one of his presentations, and there's a fish called the hamo, like long, bony, eel like fish, and traditionally you only train yourself so that you can just cut the bones without hurting your mouth when you eat it. But then he had a client who's a doctor, so he asked CT scan that hamo fish so that you can analyze the bone structure, which never happened. So you don't have to train 35 years.
Interesting.
Yeah, so that kind of.
Yeah, but and that's what I think, you know, goes back to, I think a lot of things comes out of that when you're not bound by tradition, and when you can actually think of it in a different way than a Japanese chef would do.
Right. Yeah, I think gradually, thanks to all those inspiration from non-Japanese chefs, I think Japanese traditional chefs are more kind of evolving, not breaking tradition, but evolving. So I think that's a great point, that Western chefs are really interested in Japanese cuisine. Okay, so the other thing I heard, so you're inspired by Japanese style austerity. So what part of Japanese austerity is unique and appealing to you?
I think what's so inspiring by Japanese hospitality is that it's at least comes off this way. Mm. But it's very genuine, right? And it's also all-encompassing, right? Like you would feel it. Like this really is a pride to serve someone. Mm. There's pride in it. You put, you know, all your soul and energy and everything into serving people. And that's really what the hospitality industry is. And I think that gets lost a lot of the times in West, you know, whether it is here or in Sweden. It's not the same pride in serving someone and dedicating your career and life to service. And it goes from, you know, it goes from the person at the door to, you know, the server to the cooks to the dishwasher, actually.
Right.
You know, I remember when I saw, it was some TV show long time ago, but when it was about some Japanese, I think, hotel or something. Mm. But when the dishwasher comes in with his own briefcase and still has a shirt and a tie underneath the uniform, takes a lot of pride in what they do. So, because everything matters, right? From a guest experience, everything matters.
Mm.
Like, if your plates aren't clean, if your pots aren't clean so the cooks can use it, or cutting boards, whatever it might be, it's not going to work. It delivering great hospitality only works when everyone works together, and each element is as important to some degree to deliver that.
Mm.
And that's what I really admire and appreciate.
Yeah, I think it's almost like everybody has a part, and you have to be responsible for that part. That's the mindset, like starting from school kids cleaning up the classroom by themselves, not the cleaning lady, you know, after school, to lifetime employment, where you really are responsible to continue the life of this company. So that kind of mindset probably is related to the restaurant business as well.
Yeah, and I mean, it really shows, though.
Mm. Well, what's your experience? Like, did you go to one of those Japanese kaiseki place? Or
I have been to kaiseki places in Kyoto.
Mm.
Yes, absolutely, which is amazing experience. But you feel it, even if you go to simple. I remember this. I think it was last time I went to Tokyo. I came in really late at night.
Mm.
It was like 11 o'clock at night or something, and I just went outside. I was starving. Just walked outside the hotel, and there's this like stall open to the street, and these four older gentlemen, they do ramen, right?
Mm.
And they take such pride in doing it and how they serve it and everything. It's amazing.
Mm. Right. So it's the craftsmanship, I think.
Craftsmanship, but also like it's they care about hospitality, not only about their cooking, but the whole experience, even when it's simple ramen shop that's open to the street.
Right. I think even if you go to convenience stores, there is a element of respect, because I think there is no strong division between serving a person who's serving and being served, because we take turn. That kind of assumption is all over in society, I think. That's why everybody takes a responsibility.
Yeah.
Right. That's my opinion. But okay, so another thing is Japanese hospitality. I think it's partly because based on the lack of tipping system at the restaurants. So what's what do you think about that?
I don't necessarily think it's the lack of tipping system and everyone is equal. That can be part of it, maybe. But I think actually what the biggest part of it not always coming together as seamless in West is that, especially in the back of the house, there's not enough hospitality training.
Mm.
Like when you go to culinary school, they teach you how to cook. And it was the same when I went to culinary, they taught me how to cook, which is amazing. But no one taught me about hospitality and how to appreciate your guests and how to interact with guests or anything. And I think that makes the overall experience lack a lot. And I think, you know, restaurant management teams have a big role to play when it comes to setting the right culture and teaching hospitality, not only to your hostesses and your servers, but also to the kitchen.
Mm.
And, you know, and also, you know, you have to get everyone in the restaurant to be able to put themselves in the seat of the guest.
Mm.
To be able to say, if this was me sitting there and I got this food or I got this service or I get this dirty glass, would I be happy? Would I be happy, you know, because I'm spending my hard-earned money and my time, because time is also limited. So that's why, to me, like, you have to pay so much respect to a guest, because they have so many other choices where they can go and spend their money and spend their time. And they actually choose to come where you are to do.
Right.
And I think that's, that I don't think everyone in the restaurant business realize that or think that way.
Mm.
But I think that they should, to be able to deliver real hospitality.
Mm. Right. So just the goal for the team versus this division, that division. And I think tipping system, I think, is slightly and slowly changing, I guess, in this
country. But I guess it's changing. I mean, I think what, you know, there is certainly valid points where the kitchen is not compensated, rewarded the same way as the front of the house. And I think that's to some degree in inequality. But that can be fixed, even though it's not easy and it will take time. But I think more importantly, regardless, is that hospitality is taught to the whole team and not only the front of the house team.
Right.
So if you look at most restaurants, you will have a pre-shift meeting and it will be all the servers and the managers and maybe the chef coming out, but you will never see any cooks in the meeting. And why shouldn't they? Because they're as important part of delivering the experience to the guests as the servers.
Right.
They might not be seen always, or they might be if it's an open kitchen.
Right.
And that's why I think it's important. And you know, to one extent, if I go back to when I was with Marcus Amazon Group recently, and you know, we had Red Rooster, and I've done this in other restaurants, you know, if a guest sends back a dish because it's not cooked right or whatever reason, I will have the chef bring the food out to the guest when they cooked it the second time. Just because I think it's important for the back of the house to have a guest experience, and especially when it might not have been the best one, to realize that there actually is a guest, a person there, and you can't, you know, you have to be transparent, you have to take responsibility for that.
Right.
And I think that teaches you to see the bigger picture of hospitality rather than just standing in the kitchen by the stove cooking and then handing it over to a server to deliver it.
Yeah, it's a great source of motivation for the chefs too.
Yeah.
Because like what they mean, they do is meaningful.
Exactly. But also take responsibility when something doesn't go right.
Right, exactly. Right. And I remember one time in Tokyo, a while ago, I went to a restaurant, and then I asked so many questions about dishes. And then I asked a bunch of questions to the server, and they happen to be usually a cook, and they take turn. So I think
once
a month or twice a month, that's my day. So he was like an encyclopedia. And it was so much more fun and for him too and the whole team. So I think that's a great idea to experiment. Like, I think a lot of restaurants started to, you know, have cooks to serve at the table lately.
Absolutely. But I really think it goes back to get everyone to understand what great hospitality is and how it's delivered. And it's only works when everyone comes together.
Right. I can't agree more. Right. So by the way, I heard that you are now based in New York, but you also have a base in Singapore. So what are you working on right now?
So I'm working on a few different projects. I mean, I have a few clients I work with in New York area, but then working on a project in Jamaica, in Port Antonio, which is a small boutique resort.
Wow.
Which is going to be amazing. And then currently working on a project in Bali as well, actually on the beverage side for a hotel there. And we also have a couple of projects in Singapore. So, and, you know, in the past years, I have done stuff in Bermuda and London. So it's interesting. You get to see a lot of different cultures and, you know, work different places around the world.
Right. So your spirit of being open-minded and try something new is still here, and that's why you came to New York in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. But I think, you know, experiencing different cultures and working with different cultures, different ingredients, that's really where you learn the most.
Right. Okay, so... All right. I mean, good luck. And I'm so...
Thank you.
I hope you're going to keep us posted. You can come back one of those interesting project.
Absolutely.
Completed. Okay. So so where can we find your update? You have any website or...
Yeah. I mean, we have a website. It's buyabsolute.com where you can see more about what we do.
Okay.
And such.
Sure. By the way, do you apply some Japanese principles to your consulting business?
I mean, in terms of hospitality, and yes, certainly still when I work on menus and stuff, I do always, almost always incorporate Japanese ingredients one way or the other.
Great.
Because it's been such an important part of, you know, my culinary journey for a long time.
Right. Wow. So I really admire what you do. I mean, it's just really important that somebody like you discovers Japanese cuisine, something special. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Akiko.
Okay, so listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for guests or topics of the show, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or kikokatema.com. And Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, and Stitcher podcasts. And please go to iTunes and Stitcher and write a review, and we really appreciate your feedback. And today's show was made possible by Chef's Collaborative and engineer is David Tatasciore. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.